You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by the Museum of Food and Drink. Museum of Food and Drink will be holding a Get the Ball Rolling fundraiser on March 27th at 1 p.m. at Del Posto. For tickets and more information, go to mofad.eventbrite.com. And that's B-R-I-T-E, eventbrite.com. Welcome to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, Chef Smarty Pants, your host. And so because of my work, you know, I'm a chef and chef instructor. And through that and various other connections and projects and, you know, the professional web that is life in New York, through that, I sometimes get these opportunities to participate in things that I find super fun sometimes and exciting, and yet also morally reprehensible and repugnant. Now, before your dirty mind spin out of control wondering what I'm talking about is that I get invited to be involved in branding sessions for food marketers, like focus group panels for giant mega conglomerate food producers. Basically, the people who I think are the devil want me to come in and give them my opinion about their product, which I think is pretty interesting. So I get asked to be in these groups with various other professionals, some people from the food world, some people not, to talk about food or their particular food and how I feel about it, how we all feel about it. So it's kind of just like this show, like doing this. I get to basically sit and talk about whatever I want about food, but not with my own agenda, which I get for this show. And I always try really, really hard to get my agenda in there when I'm there. I sort of feel like it's my little chance to like stick it to the man and get paid for it. And it's interesting, though, because they keep calling me back and they always say how great they thought I was and they loved hearing what I had to say. So maybe they like the whole spectrum of opinions. I don't know. But anyway, yesterday I was in this group that made my agenda boil over with rage, basically. So sometimes the groups are, you know, they're all for different things. So one time I did one and it was all about chocolate. Some luxury chocolate company wanted me to come in and talk to them about what I saw as, you know, trends emerging from chocolate land and people's perceptions of chocolate. And one time I did one, it was about like perceptions of taste in mass market beer. That was pretty interesting. We did like a blind tasting. Sometimes you don't even know what they're working on. It's all like very obtuse and abstract. And they ask you questions about like flavors and colors and sort of like free association. And those are the ones I like the best, actually. They're sort of free form. You know, and you're there for like 2 hours. They hand you a couple hundred bucks and you're out the door. And, you know, I walk out of there feeling sort of like a total whore. But then I go and I spend the money on things like artisan cheese or local microbrews, or I'm going to buy tickets to the fundraiser for the Museum of Food and Wine with it, food and drink with it. So, you know, so that's good. It's sort of like, you know, redistributing the wealth, sort of like Reaganomics for the liberal set, you know, take it from there, trickle down, sort of like Robin Hood, maybe. So it's okay. So even though I sort of feel dirty and whorish, I take that money and I put it, you know, where it should be, like your local microbrew or someone like that. So anyway, yesterday's branding session that I was a part of was about kids snacking and kids healthy, you can't see me making air quotes, healthy snack products, which, you know, was sort of an oxymoron to begin with. And the focus was on packaging and how to package these healthier kids snacks so they would be more fun, also in quotes, and appealing to kids. And really what it was about was how do these mega food conglomerate companies create lines of snack products that are perceived as healthier by the parents but are also appealing to the kids? And how do they make the packaging appealing enough so that the kids will become identified with the brands and will know what brands they want from the moment they pop out of their moms, which is what they're really going for, getting them younger and younger and younger. And so they're packaging all the same kind of, you know, evil industrial food slurry in, you know, green packaging now and calling it organic and taking out the corn syrup. you know, it's still the same old shit, but it's got a health halo on it now, basically. So we come in and there's this table that we sit down at. Everybody gets a name tag, and the table is completely covered in these products, packs and packs and packs of snack food, and then a couple bottles of wine, and also some juice, a couple bottles of wine. So a lot of, like, fun snack kind of stuff, but like I said, with the big old health halo ringing around it. So things like pop chips, which are like Pringles, basically, but they're puffy. They taste really bad. I tried them. Or like organic gummy bears. Amy's organic gummy bears. Yeah, organic gummy bears, right? They're supposed to be better because the colorings used in them are natural colorings, not artificial colorings. But I tasted them and they're not gummy. There's no resilience. There's like no bounce back. You bite in and instead of bouncing back, you just sink into this like sticky morass. So, you know, colors be damned. If I'm eating gummy bears, I'm eating the real ones. I don't want the Amy's Organic. And, you know, Amy's Organics is like that company that basically made it acceptable for kids to eat boxed macaroni and cheese at every single meal because it was made from organic white flour and organic powdered cheese packet sprinkles. So, not so sure about Amy's Organic. But, so there was all of this stuff, and there were these, like, puffed banana logs. It was like, imagine, like, a cheese doodle that was straight and banana-flavored and came in this, like, very space-agey-looking container. But they were organic bananas. Well, you know what? Organic bananas doesn't make sense because bananas have such a thick skin. They're not really getting sprayed with anything anyway. But anyway, those, and they were like banana cheese doodles for teething infants. And there were power bars and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So there was that. And then there was wine for us to drink so we could get really loosened up and kind of let our opinions flow free. But of course, you know, it was me, so I didn't need the wine. The juices flow with me without getting juiced up. So there was all that. And then there was this one thing on the table that kind of stood out to me, and it was kefir. In pouches. So kefir, maybe you call it kefir. I always called it kefir. Turns out it's kefir. Kefir is this drink. It's like a yogurt-y kind of drink. It's not really yogurt. It uses different bacteria and it's more fermented. And it's this, like, you know, kefir is like this 2,000-year-old product. People have been drinking it, you know, since the nomads in Mongolia figured out if they put milk in a skin and rode on their horse with it, it would ferment. And it's really good for you. Like, real kefir is great. Really good for you. Really healthy. So they had this kefir for kids in these pouches. Now, maybe I'm totally out of it because I don't have kids and I don't really shop in supermarkets. But it came in this shelf-stable packaging. So it didn't have to be refrigerated. It was in this pouch that to me looked like an IV bag. But it was blue. It was like an IV bag full of kefir for kids to, like, suck down. And I guess that's good because it doesn't spill, it doesn't make a mess. You don't need a cup. I guess, it, like, if you're in the car, it makes sense. I don't know. But I opened one up and I squeezed it accidentally and it came shooting out all over the table and it was a little obscene. But they had these pictures of cartoony bugs on the packages and I guess I thought that the bugs looked more like when they illustrate what bacteria and germs and viruses look like on cleaning products. As opposed to, like, I think they were supposed to represent all the healthy probiotic bugs in the kefir, but to me it was like bacteria illustrated in cartoon form. I wouldn't drink it. I don't know if I were a kid if that would be appealing to me. So, but it was like a really good example of taking a perfectly good product like kefir and turning it into like something that was designed to look like junk so that kids who are programmed for junk would actually then maybe drink this. I don't know. It was very strange. I'm still trying to figure it out. But all that pouchy stuff seems to be really popular now in packaging. And maybe this has been around for a long time. I saw them years ago in Japan, but maybe I'm really out of it. I don't know. So anyway, for 2 hours, we sat and we talked about snacks. They wanted to know what our memories of snacks were, what our favorite snacks were when we were kids, what snacking meant in our houses, what we snack on now, if we have kids, what we feed them, if we know other people's kids, what those kids, you know, all of that, what our emotional connections were to snack food, how we were influenced by the packaging, all the standard, like, industrial food manufacturers' attempts to get inside the mind of the consumer. And so I, you know, I fought the man all the way through and put up my good fight, you know, explained to them that regardless of what you call it, if you say it's organic, if you put it, it's still stuff in packages. It's still removing people from the real food experience. If you put a fruit puree in a squeezable pack and give it to a kid, the kid is not going to be able to distinguish that from the experience of eating the real fruit with its smells and its textures and its visual appeal. The kid is programmed to just think of food as stuff that comes in aseptic packaging. So I said my piece, collected my $250. Nice. Ka-ching. They said they loved me and said they want me to come back and they want to use me again. Go figure. Who knew? And, you know, like I said, since I don't have kids and I rarely go into supermarkets, I guess I'm a little out of the loop with all of that stuff. It's all about no mess, no utensil, no spill, totally convenient now. Like, what happened to that, the glass-lined thermos? Now I'm showing you how old I am. My first thermos had a glass lining, and I dropped it one day in the nursery school parking lot, and the inside of it shattered. And then I couldn't drink my milk that day in nursery school because it was full of broken glass. So I guess it's an improvement. I don't know. I've noticed that, like, a lot of these products, too, were not necessarily junk. It was, like, actual food packaged this way. Like I was saying, the fruit purees and applesauce. Things that had only one or two ingredients. Pureed apples, pureed pears, whatever. But they were still in those pouches. And so they would be, like, sucked right out of the pouch. And I guess if you're feeding a baby, that's better than those little glass jars because the light on the glass jars makes them degrade. And so this can probably be shelf stable longer. The packaging takes up less space, less shipping. It's lighter, less landfill space. And, you know, I'm trying not to be judgmental. I'm trying not to be judgmental. Since I'm not a parent, but I'd like to think that if I were, I would be the kind of person who would take a banana, mush it up with a fork and feed it to the kid, as opposed to buying banana puree in a space age pouch. It's almost like the 2011 version of Tang. Like when we were little, it was all about Tang. Making a basic fruit puree isn't that hard. Why do you have to put it in this pouch? And like I said, take the kid totally away, removed from the experience of the actual food. I don't know. The only kid I've ever really had a lot of experience with food, you know, is my niece, who's now 11, who spent the first year of her eating life in Rome. And so she is quite the sophisticated eater. She never ate anything that came in a package. All her food was just mushed up versions of whatever her parents were eating. So we never experienced that, but I now have a new niece on my other side, not related to me side. She's about 10 months, and she's been eating food lately, and everything she eats comes from packages. She's the total corporate food baby. Everything comes from a package. And she eats those banana puff logs, and she eats the organic pureed peaches and pears, but it's all from packages. Like, none of it is actual, tactile, real food. She just eats the, you know, fruity flavored cheese doodle puffs and the pureed, whatever. And it's food, but it's not food. It's food that's been processed down so it fits into that packaging and aseptic and removed and no bother. And it's just corporate American food. Junk, yet again, you know, made sort of safe and easy and accessible. And, you know, try not to be judgmental here, but I don't know. If she associates all her eating and her snacking with little packages of things, how will she ever develop any sort of relationship with an actual food? I don't know. Anyway, then there's like the whole question of the chemicals in the packaging. You know, anytime you put something in one of those packages, the package is lined with plastics. The plastics leach BPA. If you heat the stuff up, if you leave it out in the sun, if the stuff in it is acidic, you're still going to get all those chemicals. Why expose your kid to even more of that than they need to at such an early age? I don't know. Do we need everything to be in aseptic single-serving pouches? I really hope not. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, I'm changing the subject.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 2:30 p.m., tune into Cutting the Curd with Ann Saxelby. And if there's one thing Ann Saxelby knows, it's cheese. Cutting the Curd finds Ann disseminating that dairy know-how to the listening public. Every episode also includes guests from the world of dairy, ranging from historians to farmers, chefs to cheesemongers, all engaging in dairy discourse so that you might gain a better understanding of this thing we call cheese. Again, that's every Sunday at 2:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm Erica Wise, Chef Smarty Pants, your host. So after my experience in corporate food branding brainstorming session land yesterday, I had packaging on the brain. I was thinking about all of that. And I was thinking a lot about how food can be cooked and held to make it convenient in packages that aren't as wasteful as things like juice pouches or jars or boxes, and also how they can be less chemically laden. And, one thing that really struck me this last week as I've been watching the horrific events in Japan that have unfolding, heartbreaking events in Japan, is that every time I read an article or saw, a news story about people in shelters, and they talked about people being cold and hungry, they talked about how they were being given rice balls. And in Japan, Japanese rice balls are called onigiri. And onigiri are these triangular blocks of sushi rice that usually have some kind of filling inside, like some cooked salmon or pickles, or they use cod roe. And it's pressed into a triangle and then wrapped in nori. So it's like portable. It's like hand, you walk around with them. You can buy them at 7-Eleven. You can buy them everywhere in Japan. They're like notorious. It's like, the hot dog or it's like what's the equivalent? I don't know. Like a sandwich, really. But they're versatile. You can leave them out at room temp for a while. They're okay. And they kept saying, oh, people were being given rice balls, onigiri. And for some reason, I found that kind of very moving. The genius about the onigiri, too, is that they've devised this way of wrapping them, this plastic wrap, very, very thin plastic wrap, where the nori doesn't actually touch the rice until you remove the outer wrapping. Some brilliant person figured this out. And as you pull the plastic wrap off the onigiri, the nori kind of slides into place. I don't even understand how it's done, but it's brilliant. And then the nori stays crisp and it wraps around the rice. And then you have this very handy edible package. You don't need a fork. It doesn't make a mess. When I was staying in Tokyo years ago with my friend Minako, we were going to be going hiking for the day. And so she made us like 20 onigiri to take in a bag. She insisted we have them. They're like, I think onigiri are almost like a survival. Like you have to have your onigiri with you. Kids take them for lunch. They're a snack. It's what you eat. And for some reason, like I found it really touching that onigiri were being distributed in Japan to the tsunami and the earthquake survivors. Like the Japanese take their food so seriously and hold it in such high esteem that even in a crisis like that, the food that they're handing out is something that's familiar and also really high quality. And I found that just some very striking about that. And after that, so I was, that packaging, like I thought, wow, what a contrast, to what they were being handed out to these survivors versus, what, I don't know, happened in Katrina. Who knows, people even got any food given to them. But then today I was teaching and we were doing our steaming lesson. And in our steaming lesson, we do this thing called cooking en papillote, which is where you take parchment paper and you cut it like into a heart shape, and you put food on one side of the heart, fold the other side of the heart over in half, and then kind of fold it up and lock it closed. And so whatever you're cooking inside of there steams inside of its own juices. So we do salmon in there with herbs and vegetables, and we put a little bit of wine in there. You wrap it all up, you put it in the oven, and it steams in its own moisture. And it can be good if you do it right, but frankly, I don't love it. I mean, steaming fish is good if you know how to do it and you do it right, and if you do it in a steamer. Something about that bag of soggy paper, though, just, I don't know. It's tricky to get it done right. So what I decided is we would do a quick refresher course on how to make beurre blanc, because those students at this point haven't done beurre blanc in about 6 weeks. And beurre blanc is just a basic white wine and butter sauce. And so I had them each mix up a batch of that, and we dumped beurre blanc all over that salmon, and then that was really good. But I thought it was kind of interesting that today was the day that we did our fish en papillote, and I had all this kind of food packaging stuff going around in my brain. And then, of course, I started thinking about all sorts of other types of packaging for food where you either have zero waste, or at least zero plastic or paper waste, or where the wrapping is completely edible, too. And so I was thinking, because it was Tet not that long ago, which is Lunar New Year in Asia, of all these things they do in Vietnam with banana leaves and sticky rice. And so they make these things called banh tet, which I think I actually talked about last year during Tet, which is like a sticky rice cake that gets filled with braised pork and then wrapped in banana leaves and then steamed for like 12 hours. So everything gets really, really soft inside. And the banana leaves help to kind of keep it all enclosed, and they also kind of preserve it too. And they wrap them in these strings, just in like cotton string or even in like a strip of banana leaf fiber. And then when you're ready to serve it, all you do is pull on the string, and the string is tied so that it slices right through the cake and it cuts it into serving size wedges. And then you eat the sticky rice inside, and then the banana leaf you just, you know, here toss on the compost, there you just toss it out into your backyard and let the pigs eat it. You know, so it's the contrast of that against the aseptic packaged IV bag full of pasteurized flavored yogurt was somewhat profound to me as I was putting together all the ideas for this show concept today. And then, of course, I remembered something else, which was that years ago I went to Borneo. Yes, I know that sounds like the beginning of like a joke. One time when I was in Borneo. But yeah, I did go to Borneo, and I went on a river trip there in dugout canoes. It was a guided river trip to go deep into the jungle to visit this tribe, this indigenous tribe that they were former headhunters in Borneo, and they live in longhouses, which are these amazing, massively long communal houses where like hundreds of people live together, built way up high on stilts in the jungle. They're not headhunters anymore, but now they invite tourists to come and spend the night with them in their longhouse and, you know, drink and watch them dance around and stuff like that. So anyway, I went on this trip, and the guides, there were these two older guys who were our guides, and we got in the boats, and all the food was going to be provided for us, and they had a cooler with them. We didn't know what was in the cooler. And so, you know, we're paddling. We spend the day going down the river. And then around lunchtime, we stop, everybody gets out, we sit on the banks watching them. And in about a half an hour, these guys, using machetes, went into the jungle, chopped down a bunch of bamboo leaves, and built a kitchen, complete with utensils, grill, everything, out of machetes, bamboo, and banana leaves. They took strips of bamboo and wove them together and made a grill. They built a fire, and they put the grill over the fire. They opened up the cooler. They had all this fish in the cooler, and they had a whole pig's head, like a butterflied-out pig's head. Put that on the grill, grilled that up, grilled the fish. While that was all cooking, they cut sections of bamboo, and if you don't, like, bamboo, it looks like one big long tube, but it's actually divided about every 8 or 9 inches. There's a separator in there, so you can turn them into cups. So they gave us each a tall bamboo cup with coffee they brewed right there. They made us coffee. They cut little spoons out of bamboo, gave us each a spoon for stirring our coffee. And then the one guy, this was the most amazing thing, he took a really big fat stalk of bamboo, a section, he poured rice into it, dry rice, filled it up with water, and then bunched up a banana leaf and made a stopper and stopped up the end of it. And then he put that right in the coals, the burning coals of the fire, and he made his own rice cooker. The rice steamed inside of this bamboo package. So they created this entire meal in this entire kitchen, all the utensils, all the cooking tools, everything, out of the jungle. We sat there on the banks and, you know, we ate our rice and our fish and our pig's head and we drank our coffee and we had a great old time. And then they said, okay, let's go. It's time to move on. And we got up and they took all those utensils and tools and pots and everything they had just made and they just chucked it back into the jungle where it, I'm sure, broke down in about 20 minutes because the jungle is a voracious self-composter. And we got in the boats and we kept going. And I was so impressed and just floored by A, the skills they had with their machetes. I mean, what these guys did with machetes put all us Western chefs with our fancy knives to shame. But everything was served. Oh, yeah. And also lunch was served on banana leaves. So we didn't have to have plates. We just ate on the banana leaves, which is pretty common in South Asia and Southeast Asia, like in India. They'll serve food right on a banana leaf and then you're done and you just crunch it up and toss it in the backyard. But it was the most like amazingly efficient and ingenious meal preparation I've ever seen in all my years. And, you know, nothing came in a squeezy pouch. Nothing looked like an IV bag. Nothing was in a plastic bottle. We didn't leave any trash behind. We didn't litter. We just threw everything into the jungle and got back in the boats and went off to hang out with the former headhunters. So that's something to think about. Next time you're buying things in single serving pouches or, you know, wondering whether you should buy the little tiny individual portion of something or maybe get the big one and take it home and break it down into smaller packages. I don't know. Anyway, before we end tonight, because we're just about out of time, I do want to mention, you know, I'm involved in a program in Vietnam called Streets International. It's a training program for street kids and orphans to train them to work in the hospitality and tourism industry. And Streets has a yearly fundraising benefit. This year it'll be held on Wednesday, March 30th at the Astor Center. And should be great. There'll be a whole bunch of us doing food stations. Anita Lowe, who else? I can't remember. A whole bunch of people. Can't remember. And me, of course. Last year it was great. It was a blast. Lots of fun. Great food. If you are interested, you can go to streetsinternational.org. to get tickets and to see who else is going to be involved. And of course, don't forget to get your tickets also for the fundraiser for the new Museum of Food and Drink, which is going to be an amazing undertaking. And that will be held on March 27th at Del Posto. And you can go to Eventbrite for that to get your tickets. So we're just about out of time. Thank you for listening to Why We Cook. And thanks to Jack. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA.
In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house, where it is boiled gently over a wood fire just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1 liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.